From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
It appears to me that this type of delivery is an impediment, especially for this vulnerable group of children and their families. The road to hell was paved with good intentions, and I'm sure you have that. But you are experimenting with my children's lives, and I'm sick of it.
It's wonderful that you're talking to each other, but are you talking to the children in care and what they specifically need? And is that an ongoing thing and an ongoing meeting that you're having? Because if that's not, then you're already behind the game.
Timothy Evans has been the chief judge for 18 years, longer than anyone in the modern history of Cook County's court system. That longevity is too long, according to challenger Judge Lorna Probst.
After 18 years, a vote for new leadership is not an act of disloyalty. It's a commitment to the future of the court.
We have brought reforms to our court, which are both innovative and compassionate, and equally importantly, embraced changes which continue to produce justice for those who appear before us.
One of the most important elections in Cook County, but only a few people get to vote in it. That's for the Cook County Chief Judge. Timothy Evans staying in that role. We'll discuss that. Also, the state's Child Welfare Agency on the hot seat again, and we'll find out what was talked about at a legislative hearing this week, and the Pritzker administration warning of a more austere budget that could be coming in the next year. We'll talk about all of that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, now the retired director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie was also a longtime state government reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. In our Statehouse studio, we have Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio's Statehouse editor, and joining us by phone today, Hannah Meisel, a reporter from The Daily Line. And Hannah, it's always good to have you on once again.
Glad to be here.
I'm going to start with you, Hannah, because you were at the hearing regarding DCFS this week, I guess the most embattled state agency there is. It was the focus of a hearing, and this one was over how kids in the agency's care might access health services coming up. What's going on there? What's the concerns over that?
Right. So for a long time now, for the better part of the last decade, the state has been shifting to what's known as Medicaid managed care. Medicaid managed care, the argument is that instead of just, you know, regular fee-for-service Medicaid, patients who are in this managed care program, they would get a caseworker who would walk them through and basically manage their health outcomes. And this is supposed to both save money, but also provide better outcomes for these patients who, you know, may not have been exposed otherwise to, this is how you get proper care. This is how you get preventative care, so you're not showing up to the emergency room. Now, on November 1st, about 17,000 kids who are in the state foster care system, they're supposed to be switched over from this fee-for-service Medicaid to managed care. But the hearing on Tuesday revealed that it's, you know, neither DCFS nor HFS nor the actual managed care company called Illini Care seem to be at all ready for that switch. We are less than 2 months away, and most of the items on the checklist that were supposed to have been done seem left undone. And so some of the Democrats who are, you know, in charge of these committees, they told me that they were going to write a letter to the J.B. Pritzker administration to ask for a hold off, because the argument is that if kids aren't getting adequate care right now, things could get even worse for them if they're shifted into a program that's completely unprepared.
Well, Hannah, the plan, I guess, on this would also be to save money, to try to, you know, get your arms around some of the costs involved. That's usually one of the reasons people say they want to go to a managed care system. Is that the main reason for this shift?
I would say it's both. I mean, Illinois is certainly not the only state experimenting with managed care. And like I said earlier, it's, the argument is better health outcomes. But of course, there is a huge cost savings aspect to this. And so what some people might call cost savings, other people, like in the hearing on Tuesday, State Senator Robert Peters, he is a freshman senator, he asked point blank the director, or one of the officials at Illini Care, do you plan to make a profit off of foster care children? And after kind of an awkward pause in which he was told to say just yes or no, he said, well, yes, we would be planning to make a little bit of a profit.
Charlie, managed care, I guess, it always brings a few negative connotations to people because we're talking about, again, a way, as I mentioned before, possibly a way to save money. And quite often that means rejecting certain plans for treatment that people might otherwise say that they need. So, I mean, it's starting out with this whole idea, there's going to be some people who are critics of it.
Yeah, and all the while that we've discussed managed care in this state going back, what, 20-some years with the HMOs, the negative aspects or the critics would say, yeah, these are for-profit companies and the way they make profits is by denying people services. The theory under managed care is that rather than the state for people who are its wards paying the costs of their health care as the services are provided, the state hires an independent contractor and says, I'll give you $100 a month and if you agree to take care of all of Wheeler's expenses. And if he has no expenses, you keep the 100. If he has 105, you're out 5. And the fear or the criticism is that in the interest of making money, they will deny the care. Another aspect that enters is from the healthcare managed care company's perspective, they try and enlist medical providers, doctors, hospitals, and so on, who are willing to take less than their normal fee in return for the guaranteed business. But because of these provider networks, someone who has maybe dealt with a pediatrician and has a good relationship suddenly finds that pediatrician is no longer in the network. And so if they want to have the services covered and not have to pay for the whole thing out of pocket, then they have to go to a different pediatrician. So those are the big arguments against it. The for-profit motive skews medical decisions on the side of saving money, and the ability for someone who is in managed care to choose their own provider is limited.
So, Hannah, you mentioned some of the concerns there, and that there's a pending deadline that's just a few weeks ahead. At this point, do we know if this is a done deal? Is this going to move forward one way or the other, or is there still a possibility some change could occur?
No, like I said, some pretty influential Democrats, the chairs of both the Adoption Child Welfare Committee and the Appropriation Human Services Committees, they told me that they were planning to write a letter to the Pritzker administration asking for a hold off. And I feel like that is a likely outcome, especially because these very influential Democrats were not at all satisfied by the answers that Illini Care and DCFS gave on Tuesday about the preparedness of their ability to take on these 17,000 kids in foster care, but also about 19,000 kids who have aged out of foster care, but they're still under 26, because remember, under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, people can get insurance from their parents until they're 26, so this would be the equivalent. And, it was asked of DCFS and Illini Care on Tuesday, how are you going to find these kids who have aged out of foster care and let them know that they're even eligible for medical care? Because, the Illini Care, one of the officials even admitted, like, once kids age out of foster care, they couch surf. I'm not speaking for all of them, but a great number of them tend to couch surf. A number of them end up in the criminal justice system. It's really hard to locate this kind of transient population. And so if you don't have, if you set out to find these 18,000 kids and say, like, here, please, come be part of our healthcare pool, and you can't find, maybe like 10%, then what good is your healthcare pool? Because the bigger your healthcare pool is, the theory goes that the more stable it is, because that was one of the issues that we saw in the rollout of the ACA, is it's really hard to get people to sign on to be part of healthcare if they feel like they can actually get away without it, and then that shrinks healthcare pools.
Well, anytime DCFS is in the news, it's not been good, at least recently. And Hannah, there was also some more bad news regarding DCFS that has come out regarding numbers about what's happened to some kids who have been in the care of the agency.
Right. So the Inspector General, who belongs to the agency but is also, you know, separate from it, she puts out a report every January, you know, a very, very comprehensive report. But her initial findings from the end of the fiscal year, which just ended June 30th, is that 124 kids who had been in some sort of contact with DCFS in the prior 12 months had actually died. And I want to be very clear about this. It doesn't mean that every single one of those 124 kids died, you know, at the hands of their parents or, you know, from anything that's suspect. You know, some of them were just very sick, unfortunately. Some of them might have died from a car accident, maybe, or there's any number of things. But still, it's alarming that from the initial pass-through of these numbers, about 21 of them of those 124 died by homicide. Now, again, that could mean a gunshot from any number of things, or it could mean what we would traditionally think of as abuse or neglect. And then also so far in fiscal year 2020, in just the last 11 weeks, 19 kids have died. You know, who had contact with DCFS. That means either there was an open investigation into their family, or perhaps the investigation had been investigated but then closed, or the family was receiving what's known as intact family services from a private social services agency.
Those numbers are pretty shocking. And Brian, this comes on the heels of what's been a really rough few years for DCFS as far as this type of news coverage that's been out there of people finding, you know, all of these cases. The administration has put more money into DCFS, I believe, in this current year's budget. Is anybody under the belief that that's going to solve this?
Well, I don't think anyone thinks that it's a magic solution, that it's going to solve the problem. As we have said on this show before, being a sort of frontline child welfare caseworker is one of the most difficult jobs in state government because these are just very challenging situations to walk into. But improving training, improving the number of people of doing this, one imagines it can't hurt the process, but as the trend of the number of kids dying has not been a good one, even if you reverse it, there will still be some number of kids who die. Some of those cases will gain public notoriety, and that's what tends to really bring attention on this again. It was the death of a child in Will County. Has it been almost 2 years at this point that really sort of refocused attention on problems at the agency. But I think that if you go back into the archives of this show and newspapers throughout the state, you will find that every so often there is renewed attention on DCFS because it's just a really challenging mission that it has to try and fulfill.
And Charlie, you followed this agency for a number of years, and you know, I guess you would see ups and downs regarding how well things are going there. These numbers are, again, as I mentioned, I think pretty shocking to hear. That being said, does it surprise you to hear that?
Probably not that much, because the problem that exists, and in my judgment, the best director DCFS ever had was a guy named Jess McDonald, who served there for Governor Thompson. And he used to speak to my reporting classes, and he would make the point that your frontline workers and the people in the agency have these life-changing decisions to make, and almost whatever they decide is going to be wrong. Do you take a child away from a family because of a situation, or do you leave the child there? At one time, we had something like, 30, 40,000 kids in foster care. And then the pendulum or the attitude shifted, and it was like, well, we have to preserve these families. So we instituted a whole realm, a whole plethora of different family preservation programs intended to work with a troubled family, to help them deal with the challenges of being a parent and being able to take care of their kids rather than putting them in foster care. And I believe that we're down into single-digit thousands. Hannah probably knows the exact number of kids in foster care now. But it's an ongoing situation. And as Brian said, the fact that we have more frontline caseworkers is going to help, because there are certain federal court decrees saying here's how many, the maximum number of cases that an individual caseworker can have, and we've exceeded that by quite some amount. And it's the kind of situation you'll never be satisfied, because in my mind you can never accept the fact that even one child is killed in an abusive situation. But human nature being what it is, you'll never be able to eliminate the problem entirely.
Well, I mentioned that the state budget that was passed here in the spring and now is in effect for this fiscal year included more money for DCFS. But, Brian, some word coming out from the governor's office that at least many agencies may be having to cut back a bit when it comes to the next budget. They were already warning about that. Fill us in on what's going on.
Yeah, there was a memo that went out from the governor's budget director, as well as the deputy governor, Dan Hines, who is in charge, budget director Alexis Sturm, deputy governor Dan Hines, who oversees the budget and sort of economic issues for the administration, basically asked agencies to do three things. When the state agencies are preparing next year's budget, that's the budget year that starts next summer, July 1st, 2020. When you're preparing that budget, imagine that you're, they call it a maintenance funding level, which is the current year funding plus a little bit of growth for cost of living increase and so forth. Imagine that that's going to be cut by 6.5%. I'm being very careful here because the administration, how I phrase this, because the administration pushed back on this sort of simplistic description of, the governor wants to cut 6.5% in spending. But, ultimately, we're still talking about significant cuts that agencies are being told to plan for. Now, there was a huge revenue influx in the current year's budget. People remember when we first started talking about planning for this year's budget, there were concerns about how are we going to make up this huge hole. And then it turns out there was an April surprise because of changes in tax laws and some other factors that I'm not going to bore people with. There was this huge influx of cash into state government, and it kind of let Illinois hobble through. Meanwhile, as the governor's budget office is directing agencies to plan for a more austere budget for the next budget year, they are still ramping up plans to push for this graduated income tax. It's now going to be on the ballot next fall. Illinois voters will have to decide whether to end the constitutional requirement that the income tax be flat. That is, that everybody pays the same rate, whether you're making, minimum wage or making, a law firm salary or something like that. This would remove the flat tax requirement. It would let everybody, it would allow the state to impose, which this law has already been passed if the constitutional amendment is approved, to, where people at the lower end of the spectrum would pay a lower tax rate, people at the higher end of the income spectrum would pay a higher tax rate. So it kind of makes me wonder if, this is part of sort of making the case for the graduated income tax. Like, boy, we're going to have a more austere budget if voters don't approve this. But that is what the governor's budget office says agencies should start thinking about.
And Hannah, it didn't seem like that the budget plan that was passed in the spring was all that that austere necessarily. So it does seem a little surprising to hear them coming out now and saying, be prepared to hold back some money.
No, and I think Brian is right. I think this sets up supporters of the graduated income tax, which, again, the governor's office purports will bring in $3.4 billion more annually into state coffers. It sets up support for that by pressuring, there's a doomsday budget. This is a very common tactic we've seen many, many times before. But the other thing is that before this $1.5 billion of basically surprise revenue came in April, the governor had been thinking about taking a pretty massive pension holiday. He wanted to, he said in his February budget address that he wanted to basically delay $800 billion in pension payments this year. A lot of people pushed back. And then also, I should note, some analysts said, well, actually, that would be more like $1 billion. So people pushed back. People were not thrilled about it. But of course, people at the same time want to give the governor, you know, some room, some breathing room in his first year. And so magically in April, this $1.5 billion showed up as a result of basically federal tax cuts. And the governor pulled back from that plan. But, you know, if the governor, I haven't at least heard him totally go back on that plan, because it was not just for this year that he had proposed to do it, but for a couple of years thereafter.
Charlie, your thoughts on this, the governor making this, you know, only a couple of months into the new fiscal year, and he's already telling people, hey, you know, get ready.
Well, it strikes me that it's prudent, and it also has, as was mentioned already, sort of a public relations aspect. Now, if voters approve the constitutional amendment in November
of next year,
then at the second half of that budget year, there'll be a huge influx of dollars, probably, doing the math in my head, like $1.7 billion of new revenue from this graduated income tax. At the same time, if the voters don't approve it, we'll be in the same situation as we are now. Our pension payments, by law, will continue to rise unless we change the law. We have a commitment to put something like $350 million more each year into the new school funding formula. We have increases in our debt obligation, assuming that we go ahead and sell bonds for this massive public works program that was passed this year. So we have some of these kind of unavoidable expenses to deal with. At the same time, you have inflation. The new people that we hire in DCFS and elsewhere, we won't hire them all right immediately. So we're going to have to kind of phase in those salaries. So there's going to be all these expenses. So as I say, it's prudent to ask the agencies to plan for maybe trying to do with less money instead of putting together a budget expecting to get this $1.7 billion windfall. And if you recall, some years back, Governor Quinn in his final budget proposed two versions of the budget. One, with the expectation that the temporary income tax increase would not be renewed, which in fact it wasn't, an austerity budget, and then a recommended budget for what he thought should be spent if we could count on this new money. Well, the income tax was allowed to roll back, and unfortunately for the state's fiscal health, the legislature went ahead, let the income tax roll back, but then passed appropriations according to Quinn's assumptions that the income tax increase was still going to be in place.
And just a couple of minutes left here. Brian, I'm going to go to you. We have a new chief judge in Cook County. It's the same one as before. It's 76-year-old Timothy Evans. He had won a contest here this past week. Talk about what this role entails and what's been some of the issues in the race.
Yeah, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. This is a largely an administrative designation. Cook County is, of course, one of the largest, or I think the largest, unified court system in the country. So it's New York City, obviously, is a bigger city than Chicago, but it's five counties, five boroughs that have their own separate court systems. Here, Cook County is one big court system, whether it's Chicago or all the many, many suburbs. And it's unified in that you have both criminal cases, law cases, family cases. It all goes through the same court system. And one of the main duties of the chief judge is to administer that. He's got 2,400 employees under his chain of command, the budget of $272 million, 10 court divisions, 400 judges, and he also gets to decide where those judges are serving. Do they get to do interesting, complex legal fights over, you know, insurance law or something like that, or do they end up sitting over traffic court in the suburban courthouses? So that it has a lot of power. The opposition was led by a judge named Lorna Propes. She's a trial lawyer, former prosecutor, who said that Evans was not protecting judges. She was in the last retention class and complained about what she called false and misleading attacks on the judiciary by special interests. Now, the main special interest I think she's referring to in a veiled way was an outfit, a sort of advocacy reporting outfit called Injustice Watch. And they mounted I guess you'd call it a campaign, but a series of news stories, certainly, about a judge who had been accused of, when he was a prosecutor back in the day, of helping to frame some people who were exonerated after being wrongfully imprisoned. There were reports that this judge was condescending to non-white lawyers and defendants in his courtroom. That's what one of the Chicago Bar Group said. And he was the first judge in almost three decades, circuit judge, to lose a retention race. And so Judge Probst said that, you know, she would protect lawyers, but ultimately the judges in Cook County decided to stick with Tim Evans. So he will continue in this historically long tenured position as chief judge of Cook County.
Well, let's go down to our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's start with you.
Two very quick ones. Former Attorney General Lisa Madigan this week announced that she, you know, her next plans, because basically the last 8 months she has been probably taking a pretty well-deserved break, but she is going to be counsel at Kirkland & Ellis, Chicago-based law firm. And then the other is that this morning, Friday morning, a bipartisan group of legislators have proposed a new bill on curbing ethylene oxide, which would basically phase out the use of it in Illinois.
Okay, that's involved with the Sterigenics plant specifically, I believe.
Sterigenics and a couple other firms.
Okay. And Charlie?
While we're speaking about judges, the Illinois Supreme Court announced that it has a new Chief Justice, Justice Ann Burke, who is from the 1st District, which includes Cook County, or is Cook County, and she is going to succeed Justice Lloyd Carmeier, who was the Chief Justice for the last 3 years, and he's from the 5th District down in Southern Illinois. Ann Burke was named to fill a vacancy on the court in 2006. She ran and won in 2008. She was retained in 2018. And Justice Burke will serve 3 years. It's part of the traditional three-year rotation in Chief Justices. Justice Burke, of course, is married to longtime Chicago Alderman Ed Burke, who is currently under federal investigation for alleged corruption. And she becomes the third woman to serve in that position of Chief Justice.
And Brian?
Yeah, just more personnel news this week. Roger Heaton, who is a former U.S. attorney here in Central Illinois, he was one of the lead prosecutors on the MSI scandal back during the Edgar administration, and he was a criminal justice advisor and ultimately the sort of closer chief of staff to Governor Bruce Rauner. He is going into private practice in one of these high-profile law firms doing investigations and white-collar, so it means he's sort of going to the other side on high-level criminal work.
All right. Thanks to our panel, Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler, and Hannah Meisel. And don't forget, you can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.